Project Ignite Sessions, where innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship meet the brightest minds, leaders, and innovators in Colorado, our university ecosystem, and abroad. Welcome to the Project Ignite Sessions, where we sit at the intersection of innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship to have the best discussions with the best innovators that'll benefit our students, the University of Denver, and our broader innovation community here in Colorado. Today, we have two amazing guests. We have Adam Cookson, who's the CEO and founder of TechDry, one of our awesome DU alumni startups and companies here in Colorado. And we have Michael Bolin, one of our student advisory board members and also a partner, and Mike the Crowd, one of our student startups. Couldn't be more excited to have a great discussion today. And thank you both for being part of the Project Ignite Sessions. For those of you who haven't joined us before, we really try to have a casual discussion to bring out leadership, startup tips, and advice to make sure that you can grow the best companies here in Colorado as fast as you can through the support of the University of Denver and the broader innovation community. So Adam, really excited that you're here. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and I think we can start off just giving a little background before you started TechDry and kind of what got you here.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on this program. Prior to TechDry, most of my career was working for large companies like Toyota, Vestas, the wind turbine company. And within those companies, I found myself gravitating to roles where I was starting up new things. So I was typically starting up factories, building new teams, launching products around the world. Spent some years in Brazil and Mexico, Canada, different states in the US. And it was actually Vestas, the wind turbine folks, that brought me to Colorado. And that's when I started my executive MBA at DU. So that's where the connection started there.
As you started to get TechDry off the ground, I think one of the most notable things we know here in the DU startup community is your appearance on Shark Tank. Tell us a little bit how you went from class to Shark Tank and how that started to catapult your business.
Yeah, well, so I was in the DU program, graduated in 2013, and we started the business at the fall of that year. Beginning of the next year, raised a little bit of money, built some prototypes, spent some time. Actually, our first machine was in the mall here in Broomfield, which I think was invaluable. It allowed us to really get some street time, as it's called, and understand how customers interacted with the service, what we could charge, and so forth. And we were also, I want to say, almost going in all directions, trying to figure out where could we put this? Because there's so many places you can put a wet phone recovery service. It could be in retail stores, it could be in phone stores, it could be in 7-Elevens and coffee shops. So we were reaching out to all kinds of places and got some traction with a couple small repair shops, small repair chains, batteries plus bulbs, and then finally got a little bit of interest from Staples. And it was right about that time. I was also in a lot of different events here on the Front Range, different entrepreneurial events, pitch competitions, and so forth. And almost to a person, people would say, after they'd heard about the business, oh, you guys should be on Shark Tank. And at the time, I watched a lot of Shark Tank. And at the time, I was thinking, man, the deals they do on that show, they give away so much of the company. And we do a service. We don't have a product, so to speak. So I wasn't sure there was a fit. But it kept coming up. And really, our biggest challenge since the beginning was getting mass awareness. When people know about the service, they use it, they love it. But the big thing is making people even understand that a service like ours exists, where you can, rescue a phone in 30 minutes, all your data is back, we don't have to take it apart, we don't charge unless it's completely fixed. And we just need people to know about it enough to search for it, and then they'll find us. So it was starting to become obvious that this was an interesting path. As it turned out, we were well into discussions with Staples to do the next 600 stores when I actually got a call from Shark Tank. So there's three ways to get on the show. One is you stand in a line at an open casting call in some major city. Another one is you apply online. And the third one is they scout startups and they called us, which was kind of shocking. So that was a very interesting conversation, and spoke with one of the associate producers. They have a number of associate producers that sort of help shepherd different startups through the process. That was in January of 2016. The thing they tell you all the way through this process is, however, you know, there's no guarantee of anything. You could work with them for however long it takes between them contacting you and getting on the show. You could get knocked out of the process for any reason. So it's really an interesting dynamic there where you start putting more and more and more work into it and you don't know if it's ever going to turn into anything. They worked with us to come up with like our 90-second pitch, which, you know, we'd done endless times, but there was a lot of tweaking you do to make it interesting for television and all that. The stated purpose of the show is to celebrate entrepreneurship and to make good TV. So that's kind of the intersection of those two things. So they helped us tweak our pitch. That went on for like 6 months. So every week for 6 months, they'd call us up and we had to do the pitch. They'd throw us some questions. We didn't know what would actually happen if and when we got there. This was more just, I think, them trying to vet us to see if we'd, have a meltdown on TV or something. And then finally we got a call that, if you've got anything to ship, please send it to this address. And we thought, I guess this means we're going to tape. So we got plane tickets. We ended up in Culver City. And that was kind of a crazy experience. We're there. We were there at the same time with other startups who were filming on that day. They film, I think, anywhere from 12 to 14 a day. It's like back to back for the, I feel a bit bad for the Sharks. They're there in 3 week segments, full days taping. It's just crazy. And we ended up taping on the last day of that 3 week segment. So they were pretty hangry. They were ready to get out of there. And we'd actually sat in a trailer from 6:30 that morning until almost 5 p.m. at night, not knowing, like at any moment, we could have been called to go in or we could have been called to say, sorry, you're back on a plane going home. So it was really nerve wracking. And we got in there. We spent a little over an hour, I think. You kind of lose track of time in that kind of high adrenaline situation. And at any moment, there was at least three of them talking at the same time. We were amazed they were able to edit it into anything. Everybody in the set is individually mic'd. There's a camera on everybody all the time, so they can really pick and choose, you know, who gets to speak. But it was both incredibly stressful but incredibly entertaining. I mean, you're in the room with all these celebrities and just watching what they're doing. You know, they have their own brands, their own personal brands they're trying to promote as well, and on one moment, they're asking you a question. The next one starts to make a joke about it. The third one says, hey, give these guys a chance. And the fourth one asks a different question. And we had to really try to direct, like, okay, I'll answer yours later, or just ignore people and keep talking. And I don't even remember half of what we said. You know, it was so intense. It's like a car accident or something. You don't really remember it afterwards. But we got to the end of it. And I was really happy. We were both really happy with Craig and I, my co-founder, with how it turned out. Went to the trailer afterwards. We got a deal from, we got an offer on the show from Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful. So we spoke with his people immediately afterwards. And that was interesting. But at the same time, there was no guarantee of being on the show. So it's like, so now what? You know, and go back to your regular job and kind of pretend this never happened and you can't talk to anybody about it. So this was June. And we could have been aired anywhere from September to the following, like May, or never. So it's one of these things where it's like 6 months of work, this massive brain draining experience, and then you don't know if anything's ever going to come of it. And in the meantime, we're talking to Mr. Wonderful's team the whole time, trying to figure out what we're going to do. He helped us a lot with Staples. We already had the contract, I'll say, pretty much in the bag. It got signed shortly after we taped. But he was best friends with the number two guy at Staples. So he called him up and was able to let the cat out of the bag with a small team within Staples that we had been taped and they felt like there was a good chance we'd be on the air. So that freed up Staples to do a lot of marketing and press release stuff for us, even in advance of being in the stores, which was of huge value. And then we got a call, I guess it was the middle of September, that we'd be airing on October 7th. This was last fall. And then we had literally 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks to prepare. And, you know, we'd had, fortunately, a little strategy session a little bit ahead of that where we said, okay, there's things we can do once we know. No point doing that yet. There's other things we should do anyway, and they coincide with things we should do if we get on the show. So let's work on that. So we had a lot of stuff prepped. We had spoken with some people actually here at the University of Denver as well. They were gracious enough to host our viewing party. at the Joy Burns Center. It was amazing. And Eric, thank you for participating in that. That was the highlight of the evening. And it was just an amazing, amazing. It felt like a wedding. You know, we invited 200 people, friends and supporters showed up, and couldn't talk to everybody that evening. There was so much going on. Had an amazing viewing of the show. We had our marketing team was live tweeting and live on Facebook and live on our website the whole time. We were watching the numbers spike through the roof. It was just a crazy, crazy experience. But yeah, for us, I'd say the majority of the value has been, and I think for anybody who gets on air on that show, is the marketing value of being on the show. You know, it's in equivalent marketing dollars, it's something like $5 or $6 million. The reach that show has, and then the fact that it continues to be rerun every couple of months in different markets. We can see that on our website. You know, like something will go through the roof last Tuesday, and it's like, it was a rerun last Tuesday. So that's just been wild.
It couldn't be more exciting. I mean, it's great for the University of Denver. It's most importantly great for Tech Dry. And we're just couldn't be more excited that you had that opportunity and made us proud. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess how is your experience from your undergraduate degree and from the workforce prior to coming to the master's? How's that carried over into the idea?
Yeah, great question. I think, for starters, being in the executive MBA program launched the business. The people that I met in that program turned into co-founders. Some of them became investors. Some of them became advisors. And really the launching point for the business, both technically, socially, and in a business sense, very concretely, all came from that program. And, you know, the first fundraising round we did in the spring of 2014, we raised $620,000 in 2 months. And we're blown away. And it wasn't just people from the university, it was people they were connected to. So there's a network that they plugged us into, and still a lot of hard work going around and talking to a lot of people and sharing the story, but certainly made that much quicker and much more straightforward at the very beginning. I think for both Craig and I, having large company backgrounds, even though I was in a startup role, so to speak, entrepreneur, if you will, one of the big challenges, I think, for a startup, especially if you have that kind of experience, is figuring out what's transferable when. You can't just take, you know, the Toyota policy manual and go thunk and say, this is what we're doing. You know, that's not going to work. So there's a lot of judicious sort of choosing, picking and choosing of what fits the business at the life cycle and what stuff you're never going to use, what has the most value. And having a team that's very aware of that. So it wasn't just as we brought people onto the team, everyone trying to make Tech Dry like their last company because that worked. You know, there was a lot of discussion around what do we really need? How do we stay lightweight and agile and able to move quick, but at the same time have appropriate levels of structure and control as we grew.
So when you say wet phone replacement, as it relates to Tech Dry or recovery, I guess is probably the better word. Real quick, like, what's the ins and outs of Tech Dry? Like, how does it physically work? What's the technology?
So it's a machine that's a service. I sometimes joke it's instead of a SaaS model, it's HaaS, hardware as a service. So we've invented and patented these machines, and the model we eventually settled on, because originally it was going to be a consumer device, was to find places where people were already going to get phones repaired, or where marketing could convince people to go and put the service there. And where we found the intersection with retail was places like Staples, Best Buy, and others are looking for physical services to put in their stores because they've got to make these brick and mortar locations work. They're under pressure from Amazon, of course. And there's lots of services that you don't get online. And ours is, you know, one of them. You physically take your phone to the place, and the retailers love it because our service takes 30 minutes. You bring a phone in, they put it in the machine. It's as simple as pushing a button on the machine. There's no tools. We don't open anything up. For those 30 minutes, what do you think the customer's doing? They're wandering the aisles and they're shopping and buying things, which is exactly what the retailer wants. So they love it for that. It also creates these emotional experiences. So 30 minutes later, the phone pops out of the machine. They hit the button. We've had people like break down in tears because they had photos of you can just imagine all the things people take pictures of, but there's especially, you know, emotional ones where people have had deceased relatives, and the only place was on this phone. Or others have run around the store literally giving high fives to every associate in the store. I mean, that doesn't happen in an office supply store, you know? So that was the other real surprise is, yeah, there's some cool technology here. It's a vacuum chamber. There's no air in the chamber. It makes the water boil at a low temperature in order to, just the thermodynamics behind it, in order to not make an ice cube, you have to put a little bit of heat in. So the beads, there's these metal beads, and it's sort of like the balls at the McDonald's play pit that your kids jump in. You put your phone in these beads and it sits in the beads and they keep it just warm enough, like a warm bath. So it makes the water just turn to gas and it, you know, leaves the phone and it's dry down to a molecular level. And what we figured out that wasn't common knowledge was when you get a phone wet, it's not dead. It's asleep in all intents and purposes. And if you can get it dry before the corrosion sets in, it comes back fully with all its function. So 30 minutes later, you pull it out, it's working, and that's that. And you only pay when it works.
Very cool.
So how has the initial device advanced from your first prototype?
Yeah, so it actually started as we were trying to make a consumer device. We thought, oh, this will be something small and cheap enough that you could, you know, sell it at Home Depot or something, and you'll keep it in your car or your office. And the technology didn't go that way. We couldn't get it that cheap that fast. And we had some great advice from Carrie Plemons, one of our professors at DU, who was actually the one who ran that innovation course and also the one who was with us on the international trip in Istanbul, Turkey, where we pitched this idea. Lots of great history there. Who had said, guys, I think this needs to be a centralized service. You know, you can put this where people are going. And so that's where that idea came from. And so we very quickly then started to figure out, well, how do we make a machine then that fits where we might put this? And we were thinking, oh, Verizon or AT&T, and let's make a kiosk. So the first machine that we had actually a contract manufacturer help us with was the 6-foot giant. It was like 6 feet tall, 3 feet wide, 2 monitors, 3 drawers. We'd made a bunch of hand-built models before then, but this was like the first one that we'd be happy to, you know, put in a commercial space. Halfway through the development of that, we were talking with Staples and Batteries Plus Bulbs, and they revealed to us that there was no way they were going to put something that large in the store, and they had countertops, and it had to fit on that. So immediately the design direction changed. The first giant kiosk, by the way, is viewable in our office on Enterprise Co-working on Lawrence Street. It's never made it to a retail store, so it's a showpiece now. But so these countertop models, about 2-foot cube, that's what went into the first 82 Staples stores. After that, we had enough, I'll say, breathing room to do a bit more design work on it. I actually held a design competition across some different contract manufacturers and came up with a design that was radically less expensive to build, only about half the size, fits in a standard FedEx packing box, much better across all dimensions. And that's what's in the 600 stores now. That's where the design of that has evolved to at this point. Where we're heading next, actually, we're looking into medical device sterilization. So the technology we're using has applications in other areas, and that's the next step.
So as you continue to scale the company, when you look back, I mean, obviously Shark Tank was a really big blip to the positive as it relates to growing the business. What were some of those moments that you thought, man, I really shouldn't do this, or we're not going to make it?
the Wifio moments?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
We're something, it's over?
Yes, yes.
Gosh. You know, we had a lot of, and when I say we, I definitely include Craig here because he's on the sales side and has spent a lot of time talking to the places we thought we could put this thing. And we got a lot of rejections from the wireless carriers, insurance companies. The list goes on and on. And because we were trying to invent a market, it wasn't like we could point to an existing business and say, we're like that, but we're better. We were having to convince people first that this thing even worked. So, I would say that the early days where it was us in the mall and my wife, Mirella, helped staff that. That was a lot of long days. And I remember standing there with Craig and there's people streaming past us in the mall. And we were just down the aisle from the Apple store. We're at the foot of the escalator from the food court, perfect location. You'd think that it'd be easy to talk to people and get people excited about this. We had a little table, we had a sign, we had a monitor. There was days we couldn't for the life of us get people to even talk to us. And I remember one in particular where Craig and I were kind of going back and forth, well, what would it take to make people come over and talk to us? And I'm like, okay, tell you what, for the next 20 minutes, you can put whatever you want on that monitor and let's see what happens. So we started out with, I think it was like a free music download, you know, come talk to us. Nothing. Then we went to, we went through a lot of crazy iterations in 15 minutes and just ended up finally with, you know, $20 if you come talk to us. Nobody came over. And it's like, oh my goodness, how is this going to, you know, it's that's the kind of moments where you feel like you've got this awesome, magical thing and you've seen how it changes people's lives and you just can't get people to come talk to you. And those moments, you're like, how is this ever going to go anywhere? And, but then a few people would come over and it's those stories where, like I said, you rescue someone's phone that had deceased relatives or their business is on the phone. We've had you know, freelance programmers who lost their laptop and we got it back and they had just bought the MacBook sort of thing. And those are the stories that keep you going. You know, like we're really fixing a real problem here and this matters to people. And it's not just the money of the device we're saving. There's real value for that data and those memories. So that's what kept us going there.
So you kind of mentioned that probably one of the biggest challenges was, trying to show others how the device actually works and whether it worked. Were there any other challenges moving forward through, the process of getting it to where it is now?
Well, for that one in particular, I would say we actually, it's funny, in the beginning, we weren't sure how much we should show people. And now it's evolved to where we've got a video of the inside of the machine that we show people all the time. But I would, you know, I would definitely say, don't be afraid to show your idea off. It's sort of a classic paradox. Like the example I just spoke about, if you can't even get people to come and look at it, how realistic is it that someone's going to steal the idea? You know, those two things can't coexist. But it's funny because you hold those two ideas in your head and without connecting those for long periods of time. So, it's always been about the awareness. It's always been about the awareness. When people know about it, they use it. Yeah, there's been difficulties with dealing with big retail companies. It's like a 8 months to 1 year sales cycle. And it's a bit maddening. It feels like in our company, I'm sure it's similar with other startups, you feel like you're in a time distortion bubble because you can work on things right away. This is all you're working on. But you talk to a buyer at a big retailer and this is one of 10,000 things they're working on. So they're not too upset if they don't get back to you within a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And meanwhile, your business is hanging on this. So I'd say there's been timing challenges around that sort of thing, maintaining expectations, maintaining morale. And then, you know, when the big win comes through, it makes it all worth it.
What type of advice do you have for other students and other folks thinking about starting up? How'd you take those first steps? Sound like there's a bunch of ideas through your cohort and then all of a sudden it started to happen. Like, what's the advice? Like, what's that seminal moment where you're like, we're doing this?
I think the key for us and what I would share is having an idea that really solves a problem can keep you going. You know, there's going to be lots of dark moments. There's going to be times when it feels like nobody else is supporting this thing. But if you feel like you're solving a real problem, that gives it purpose. And that can really be awesome fuel for you and for everybody on the team. So it's also important that everybody on the team shares that same goal and that passion. I would say when you're looking to build your team, there's a lot of tools you can use to figure out personality profiles and this sort of thing. And I would say beyond just building a balanced team where you have different profiles of people or strengths, you really need to have a team that, what I've looked to do is have a team that in some ways is a little bit extreme in different directions. So think of it like a superhero team, right? Everybody has something they're awesomely good at. Everybody has to wear a bunch of different hats, but you have people that are really awesome at something. And even if it's a bit obsessive, I used to use the example of from Lord of the Rings, Gollum and the Ring, you know, my precious. You need people who are obsessing over their part of the business. That's how you come up with the final twists on the innovation. And, you know, look, there's lots of work in a startup that isn't all the glamorous stuff. It's just hard work. And you need somebody who sticks to it and pushes through and gets it done. And so you have to curate that on your team. People that share the same purpose, people that have something they're really good at and can also share some of the load at different times as well. I would say the last thing is don't feel like you have to, you may have the super idea, an awesome purpose, a great team. You're not alone. You know, you've got this massive network around you, especially here at DU. You know, like I said, there's an awesome faculty, cohorts, other students, networks like Excite, all the events up and down the Front Range. Oh my goodness. I mean, if you wanted to, you could go to an entrepreneurial event almost every night of the week, I think. And they're stellar. There's no excuse for not having a massive network here. Lots of great events. The day after the Monday after I quit my day job was Denver Startup Week. I mean, talk about jumping in the deep end. And I just gorged on that for the whole week. And it was awesome. It was awesome. I was going 1,000 miles an hour by the end of that week. So, you know, there's no excuse for not at least having a plan of what you might want to do because you've been able to tap into a network. So
you said you're solely right now remaining in kind of the retail space. Do you ever look towards moving online at all, or what are the plans for the future?
Well, we do have an online, people ship us phones overnight. So if we're not in a place where you have a phone, techdry.com, there's a store locator, and then there's also a mail-in service. And that's very successful. So that's really the retail part of it, the online retail part of it. The technology we have, as I mentioned before, has application in a number of different verticals. Now that we have a solid base in consumer retail, we're looking into the first next vertical in the medical space so that we can diversify, have a broader offering, and make the company more valuable.
Well, Adam, this has been absolutely awesome. I think it's been an honor to have you be part of the University of Denver community. And I think what we're always most proud of is when really great companies and great ideas, you know, start to sprout here, but then the people behind them, you know, make them much bigger than they could ever be in the walls of this place. And you've definitely done that with TechDry. So we couldn't be more excited to continue to help you, and couldn't be more excited for what's ahead in your business. As we wrap up here, always looking for those nuggets of like, inspiration and aspiration that, you know, the students that are in the class like you, what's the one piece of advice that catechismic thing that you stick to? You mentioned that, you know, there's superhero aspects in building teams and there's elements that get people excited. But when you look at that advice, that North Star that got you here, you know, what can you tell us?
I think a key ability to moving quickly and speed is definitely, I think, the greatest barrier to entry, if you will, for competition. And especially if you've come from more structured backgrounds, be willing to move forward with 70% of the information and accept the risk, accept some failures, have that as a understanding within your team that you're going to make mistakes, only operating with 70% information, but you're going to learn a lot too and move faster and come out on top because of that. So it's just, yeah, accepting some ambiguity and pushing through it and moving quick because of it.
Well, Adam and Michael, absolute pleasure having you on the show today. For those of you tuning in to the next Project Excite session, we're really excited that you tuned in to hear some of the best and brightest minds and those leading the entrepreneurial economy here in Colorado at the intersection of innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship. I'd like to say thank you to our partners, Tech Studios inside of the Cable Center right here on the University of Denver campus. The Cable Center is driving innovation across the Front Range with their activity and engagement in our ecosystem, and could be more excited to partner with them around our Excite sessions. Thank you so much. And Adam and Michael, I really appreciate your time on the show, and never stop starting up and always look to Project Excite in here at the University of Denver to help you get to that next level. Thank you. Project Excite Sessions on the University of Denver campus is produced with our partner, the Cable Center. You can always visit upcoming episodes of Project Excite Sessions at projectexcite.org.